often before I give a class, I ask, does anyone remember anything from the last class? Now, if you can remember something from the last class, doing really well. Only Saul remembers him. Where'd he go? He's disappeared. there was a long story that was unfolding of Krishna. Of Krishna and how the Rajasuya sacrifice was performed, king of all sacrifices. And if some of you may remember how we heard about Krishna's daily activities, because Krishna is the most mysterious of persons, because Sambhavam Yatmamaya, that he appears in this world by his Atmamaya, by his own mercy. He's not forced. We ourselves, somehow or another, we find ourselves born in a particular family and we grow up not really understanding why we've taken our birth, but we can understand as we get older that we didn't really have direct choice causing our particular birth in a particular family with particular qualities and characteristics. It was just imposed upon us, and as we grow used to our body, as our body gets older and it develops, we just become very used to considering that this is us. But of course, the body can't be us. Why? Because we all had 3-year-old bodies, and where is that body now? I'm still here, but that body that body is gone. And we've had 15-year-old bodies, and if that was us, where is it? Where is us? If the body is us, it's gone. But yet we are still here. And it is clear that there is a continuity of identity. Very clear that we perceive that that I am the same person, even though, because we identify with the body and mind, we do perceive certain changes, but we never feel ourselves old. Actually, we don't feel old even when we are old. And the body isn't working and the mind isn't working, but we experience ourself. It's very frustrating for a soul to be in an old body, and it's also very frustrating for the soul to be in a young child's body too. Why is it frustrating? Because there's so many desires that you can't fulfill. Very true for the child, very frustrating. And also for the old person. But the child has so much to look forward to, identifying with the body, but the old person, very frustrated, very cynical, it has all come to this. Feels like leaving, but of course, there's so much attachment to the body. There's one story that's told in the 6th canto of the Bhagavatam, I think it's in chapter 10, of one Muni named Dadichi, who's quite a unique person, because there was one time there were the physicians, the Vaidyas, the Ayurvedic doctors of the demigods wanted to get transcendental knowledge from him, and they wanted to take initiation from him. He was very, very powerful, but somehow or another, Indra was inimical to these two. So he told, when he found out that they wanted to take initiation from the Dadichi Muni, he went to the Dadichi Muni and said, "Don't do it, or else I'm going to kill you. I'll chop off your head with my sword." So then the two physicians came to him, and they said, "Please, you told us you would give us initiation, so please do it." And he said, "Well, Indra just told me if I give you transcendental knowledge, in Krishna consciousness, he's going to chop off my head with his sword. So it puts me in a rather awkward position, difficult position. So they said, don't worry, we'll take care of everything because we have our powers, our Vedic health physician powers. So what we'll do, because Indra will get angry and he will chop off your head, so what we'll do is we'll be proactive. We'll chop off the head of a horse and we'll put it on your head, where your head was. We'll take off your head, no pain or anything. We'll put the horse's head, and then you give us transcendental knowledge, speaking it through the head of the horse. And then when Indra gets angry, he'll chop off your head, and then we'll come back and we'll just replace your horse's head with a human head. What's the difficulty? They actually could do it. And indeed, the Dixie Muni said, okay. So they chopped off his head painlessly, and they put on a horse's head. They chopped off the head of a horse and put it on his head. He initiated them, gave them transcendental knowledge and Krishna consciousness. Then they left. And then when Indra found out, he was so angry. I told you not to do this, and you defied me. Because, of course, this is the problem when one is powerful. And this is the problem when one is intelligent, that one tends to want to control things. And if anyone tries to move outside of our control, we think, how dare they do this? And then we become very angry. This is what it's like having a false ego. Someone has dared to go beyond what I desire. So of course that makes life in this world very difficult, because there's always so many entities that don't care what we desire at all. So many people and others, they don't care what we desire at all. They have their own plans. So anyway, when one is very powerful, this false ego problem is even greater, because you really believe it, because you have subjugated so many people. Then when someone specific defies you, like Prahlad defied Hiranyakashipu, in India they call it a prestige issue. It becomes a prestige. Do they still use that term in Bombay? Or is that just in Vrindavan? Mm-hmm. Yes, a prestige issue. You have defied me. And I've told you not to do this. And you have done it anyway. Now you will understand who I am. So of course, people who think like this usually never understand who they are. But in time, everyone will become humbled, as Hiranyakashipu was humbled, and Indra will also become humbled. So anyway, he became very angry at Dadichi Muni, and he pulled out his sword, and he chopped off his horse's head, and left him. And then the two Aswini physicians came, and they brought back his real head and just put it back on and reinstalled it, gave it new drivers, and it was just working perfectly again. And he said, no problem, like that. So later on, though, when Indra, he had a problem with Vritrasura, and Lord Narayan told him, you have to go to Dadichi Muni and you have to beg from him, because we'll have to kill Vritrasura. How will we kill him? He's so powerful, he's so huge. We will kill him with a weapon that is made from the bones of Dadichi Muni. Dadichi Muni isn't going to give us his bones. He said, he will. You ask him. Because he is not attached to his body at all. Quite astounding. And actually, Indra came, and first Dadichi Muni chastised them, because for the sake of your bodies, for your difficulties, to solve your problems, your bodily problems, you're asking me to give up my body. I mean, that's quite self-centered, isn't it? It's quite selfish and very bold. And everyone's attached to their body. But eventually, he was just testing them. And actually, he was completely detached from his body. His realization of his nature as a soul was so deep, that he saw he had no attachment to anything in this world, and even and especially to his own body. And this point, this philosophical point, that we are eternal souls and we are not the body that we happen to inhabit at this particular moment, whether it be a horse's body or a sage's body or a boy's body or an old man's body, we are not that body. This simple ABC philosophical point is not understood anywhere. Other than coming from the Vedic culture. I've seen this in looking at other religions. They just don't, they don't accept the point. They can't explain what they say, that the self, who we are, is some combination between the body and the soul. It's most peculiar actually, that the self is a combination between the body and the soul. And then what happens when the body dies? Certainly that self, that combination between the eternal soul and the temporary self of the body, is going to be quite disruptive when one takes, and of course they can't accept that you take another body either. And therefore, because of this lack of philosophical spiritual depth, it corrupts the whole religious philosophy and makes them compromise in hundreds of ways, and it becomes confused, and also it becomes deeply at odds with other religions. Because as soon as we accept that we're not our body and that we're attached, that we may be attached to the body, but we have an eternal relationship with Krishna, with God, with the Supreme Lord, but a temporary relationship with the body, then we're eternal, and we go from body to body to body to body eternally until we awaken our relationship with Krishna. Then the first thing is one has to be very careful about what one does, because what determines our journeying from one body to the next, it's our activities in this life. And one also has to be very careful. One naturally will see what's happening to him now is a result of his previous activities. So one can't just project all problems on others. You've done this to me. But actually, we've done everything to ourselves, in the sense that the pain that we experience now and difficulties we experience now, we are getting as due and just reactions to activities that we've previously performed. Otherwise, how can there be a just, fair, judicious supreme? If he's so whimsical, he gives some person born in a beautiful, healthy body with a wonderful family, healthy and wealthy and wise, and then another person just born crippled, poverty-stricken, and always in anxiety and difficulty. So what a whimsical God it must be. And how could you worship such a God? How could you trust such a God who at any time can do anything to you and cause the greatest suffering to someone? How could you trust? How could you surrender? How could you give yourself? So because of this other religions that don't understand these philosophical points, how do they get one to be religious, it's out of fear. Deep fear. Fear of God, because he is whimsical. He can do anything. So you better do what he says, or else he is going to do something terrible to you at any time. So that fear and love are not compatible. And Krishna consciousness is about developing love for Krishna, not about developing fear of Krishna. Pratasya pasyati gurunapi naparada. In the Bhakti Samhita Sindhu Nectar Devotion, there's one nice verse that Krishnadas Kaviraj quotes in Chaitanya Charitamrita, that Krishna, his nature, silam nimalapati yo purushottamyam, his nature is such that he is not envious of anyone. Viskaroti pishunasvapi napnusuyam nabhyasunyam. That he's not envious, even if you're envious of him, even if you hate him, he doesn't reciprocate and hate you. And if you commit an aparad, an offense to him, do something horrible to him, he doesn't take it seriously, he doesn't take it big. And sevam manakapi kritam bahuda abhyuprati. And if you do some seva, even manak, little bit of seva, he takes that, a service. If you do something for his pleasure, he takes that as very great. So he doesn't take offenses seriously. He doesn't take enmity with him seriously. But he takes service to him seriously. He thinks, someone has done this for me. He's unlimited, because he has unlimited good qualities, nirmala, pure qualities, silam, his qualities are unlimited and pure. He's unlimitedly grateful, even for a little bit of service. Sakrideva bapanam yas, tavas smriti chayachate. And even if one calls out to him one times, the dhammi tad vitam mama, his promise is that he gives, awards fearlessness to that person. So this is the qualities of Krishna. And knowing of the Supreme Lord and his wonderful qualities, this Adichi Muni was completely unattached to his body. Knowing that he was an eternal soul, being philosophically fixed, and realized when Indra and the demigods came to him and said, just one favor we want to ask of you. Could we have your body? We want to make a thunderbolt weapon so we could kill Vrishasura. Is that all right? Can we have your body? And he just said, okay, anyway. So quite wonderful. So Krishna is that wonderful Lord. And to hear about Krishna's pastimes, he's so mysterious. Because he's a person. That is the most mysterious thing. He's an all-powerful person. He's an all-powerful person with wonderful qualities who acts in his own ways because he's a person. He does what he does, he likes what he likes, because he's a person. He's a supreme person, an unlimited person. That's quite mysterious. He's a person, but unlimitedly powerful. Unlimitedly powerful, unlimitedly beautiful. Having no desires, because his desires, by his Ichha Shakti, by his potency, they're automatically fulfilled. But yet he acts. He has no reason to gain anything, and yet he acts. He doesn't feel the lack of anything. He's composed of eternity, bliss, and knowledge. That's what his body, eternal body, is made of. And yet he acts. So that is very mysterious. So one asks, why does he act? What is pushing him? Because it's very interesting if one considers this point. We all act and we do so many things. And we get up in the morning and we all day long we do different things. What pushes us? What is the driving force behind our activities? So in this question can be analyzed in many different ways. On the simplest way, we want something, or we want to do something to help another, or we want to worship Krishna because we love Krishna. But often, often on subtle material levels, there's something completely different driving us, and it's quite selfish. It's quite selfish. We're actually feeling insecure. We want people to like us. We want this. We want that. Something driving us. We feel like we don't have anything. So sometimes these subtle psychological things are pushing us and driving us that we don't even know, we don't know about unless we're very, very deep thinkers, introspective thinkers. But with Krishna, there's nothing driving him other than the fact that he's an individual and he likes what he likes. He's an unlimited, all-powerful individual. And also, his quality of loving his devotees, loving those, reciprocating, loving all living entities, mama eva angsa jivaloke, all living entities, but especially reciprocating with those who love him. This is what drives Krishna. So when we hear these mysterious pastimes about Krishna, sometimes we can, there are wonderful answers. Why did this happen, and why did this happen, and why did that happen? But sometimes there is no other answer in these pastimes or activities of Krishna other than Krishna wanted it to be that way. I remember last time, maybe it wasn't the last class, but now we're moving to the point where it's actually going to happen. But Krishna, there was a big issue that came up because Krishna was in the 70th chapter of the 10th canto. We were listening to Krishna's daily activities, and then he went into the assembly. Do you remember that? He went into the assembly, and he had so many palaces. How many?
1,000.
Something more than 1,000. 16 times more than 1,000. In fact, 16,000, and not only that, an extra 108, because 108 is such an auspicious number. And so multiples of 8, actually. 8 times what is 16,108?
8 times
some, it's got 8s in it. Eight times one is eight, eight times two is sixteen. 8 times 3 is 24. That'll take a long time to figure it out that way.
2,000 matches. 8 times 2,000 is 16,000.
Yeah. But then what is the multiple of 8 that goes into 2,108? 8 times 13. So it's 2,013, perhaps. That's an odd number. Anyway, sorry. It's been a long day for everyone.
Meanwhile.
Oh yeah, we were talking about Krishna. So he joined all into one Krishna from his 16,008, and he went to the assembly hall and went. And it was so interesting to me that when he entered the assembly hall, the description of him sitting there was just like a description of God, like you'd think of God. He was sitting there on a throne and very, very effulgent. It was quite interesting. And everyone was around him, you know, worshipping him. But then as he was there, a representative from kings who were imprisoned by Jarasandha came. There were thousands of kings. And they begged Krishna to free him. And then, to free them from Jarasandha, had captured them. Jarasandha was going to perform a sacrifice and kill them all. So they begged Krishna, "We are surrendered to you. Why are we suffering like this?" So Krishna said, "Okay." And then all the Yadus, they wanted immediately, all his dynasty wanted to immediately go and rescue, because they were all warriors, and Jarasandha had attacked their kingdom in Mathura so many times. How many? 16 or 17 times before. And Krishna had defeated them, Jarasandha. But now, look what he had done. And all the Yadus, they were furious. They wanted to go and immediately kill Jarasandha. And then Narada Muni came. And they asked Narada Muni how the Pandavas doing. And he said, "Oh, Yudhisthira Maharaj very much wants to perform a Rajasuya sacrifice, the most powerful sacrifice that will establish him as the emperor of the world. And he wants you to come there." So Krishna thought, "The kings need my help immediately. And Yudhisthira wants me to come immediately." And he said, Uddhava, what should I do?" Now here's the supreme, all-knowing personality of Godhead asking Uddhava, "What should I do?" But he's all-knowing. But yet he asks Uddhava, he takes advice from Uddhava. So one way to understand this, and the sweetest way, is that this is Krishna's reciprocation with his devotees. But Uddhava has some, by his nature, he has something wonderful to offer Krishna, and this brings him the greatest pleasure. And that wonderful thing is his great intelligence, very discriminating intelligence. So Uddhava says, "Well, if Yudhisthira is going to perform the Rajasuya sacrifice, you actually have to kill Jarasandha anyway. So you have to do that first." And everyone said, "Oh, Uddhava, that was so, you're such a good advisor." So immediately, of course, the Yadus didn't want to do that. They went to Hastinapur first. So the whole huge entourage went to Hastinapur. Do you remember that? It was huge, with all the queens. On elephants and palanquins and cooks and their servants, the dobies and laundry. Everyone went. They took them from all the way from Dwarka to Hastinapur by elephant and being carried.
Carriages.
How long? But Krishna, of course, can do. So someone could think, "Oh, this is such an amazing story. So amazing that I can't even believe it." No one can think that. And naturally, if we want to limit and measure God by what we think is amazing and wonderful, naturally we'll think like this. "Oh, very nice mythological story. Now tell us what really happened. Or tell us something we can believe." It's so much easier to believe that. So much easier, people will say, to believe that God... these stories are good for simple people, village people, but actually, so everyone should believe these stories. It's very good for you. It's good for you to believe all these simple village stories. And then when you become more advanced, you'll understand that he actually has no qualities. He's unlimited, and unlimited means that he has no qualities. So I will say that unlimited means, if you say that he has qualities in a form, you are limiting him. And of course, we say, if you say he can't have a form, you're limiting him. But actually, to say that Krishna the supreme, all-powerful Lord can't do these things and or shouldn't do these things is ridiculous. He's the all-powerful Lord, not me. How can I say that you, Krishna, God, you can't do this? You may want to, but you can't. Ridiculous. Foolish. One might even say proud and arrogant. Or one might even say, take it a step further, envious. How dare, I can't do this, how could you do it? You shouldn't be able to do it because I can't do it. I can't even conceive of these wonderful things. So again, sometimes it comes down, when we're dealing with Krishna's pastimes, it just comes down to Krishna wanting to act in a particular way because he's an individual, a person, and he wants to exchange loving dealings with his devotees. And this is how he's the master of this. Krishna is Rasaraj. He is the master of knowing how to evoke loving ecstasies within the heart of another. This is one of Krishna's greatest expertises. And he is the master of all rasas, all relationships, tasting and causing his devotees to taste the greatest amount of love, ecstatic love. He knows just how to do it. He knows just how to act. And he is the, what's called the Lila Purushottam, means he is the master. He sets things up, he organizes things because he's the supreme enjoyer. So he sets it up for his enjoyment, and when those who he deals with love him, their enjoyment even surpasses his enjoyment, and that is his greatest happiness. So in any case, Krishna and his huge entourage arrived in Dwarka, and then their plan was they couldn't do the Rajasuya sacrifice until Jarasandha was killed, and there were these kings who had sent a message to Krishna while he was in Dwarka that please come and save us. This Jarasandha is going to kill us. He's going to sacrifice us. We're kings and he's imprisoned us and he's going to kill us. Come, we're surrendered to you. We are your devotees. So Krishna, on Uddhava's great advice, went to Hastinapur for the purpose of doing that. So how long, and I remember it was quite astounding, you remember how long he stayed in Hastinapur?
Not
he stayed there for 3 months. And the kings were the kings were imprisoned. So what do you think of Krishna doing that?
He must have known that he'd be all right.
Well, there's a few things. Since he knows everything. But they didn't know they would be all right, right?
But he knew.
He knew. So that's one point. So what do you think? That looks what it looked like from his point of view. So what did it look like from their point of view? They had sent a message. And Krishna, the messenger came back and said, Krishna is coming. Abhyaya. Just now. I'm just now coming. We all know what that means. Might be 3 months.
Go.
But what was it like for the kings? Now, they didn't know that Krishna was going to be coming in 3 months. They just knew that he said he would be going to be coming. And they were devotees. They were fixed. And they had no choice, which often helps us be devotees. Because the choice other than Krishna coming and saving them, there was no choice. They were imprisoned by this incredibly powerful Jarasandha who was going to kill them. So they were fully taking shelter of Krishna. So what was it like from their side?
Intense.
intense, but what was intense?
They must have taken a lot of shelter with Krishna.
They were that kind. They were, and they were thinking every day, oh, maybe Krishna will come today. Maybe Krishna will come today. Next week I'll tell you a little story about that, something about Prabhupada, but I won't tell you now. Swavel, sorry. Next week I'll tell you it.
Next week?
Next week. I'll tell you at the retreat.
I'll wait patiently.
Marry him? Can you see him at the retreat? First week or second?
He'll probably completely forget.
This could be quite intense.
Yeah, right. What is this story? It's one day now. No, maybe I'll find out today. Maybe I'll find. No, it didn't. The sun has set already. I cannot find out today. Maybe tomorrow. Oh, sun, why are you taking so long to rise? Because they knew. The kings knew. Krishna was so wonderful. Worth waiting for. So they were waiting and waiting and waiting. So this chapter is going to discuss the slaying, how actually this Jarasandha was slayed in a wonderful way. So when Krishna, he got to Hastinapur, Kratya Rajena Govinda, Rajasuyena Pavani, Yakse Vibhuti Bhavatas, Tat Sampadaya Ya Prabhu. Yudhisthira, when he got to Hastinapur, Yudhisthira said, O Govinda, I desire to worship your auspicious, opulent expansion by the Rajasuya sacrifice, which is the king of Vedic ceremonies. Please make our endeavor a success, my Lord. So what does that mean? Please make our endeavor a success. Let me read the purport here. Srila Sridhar Swami states that the word Vibhuti refers to Lord Krishna's expansion, his amsa. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur further explains that here the word Vibhuti, because Govinda, Yudhisthira Vacha, Kratu Rajendra Govinda, Rajasena, Yakshe Vibhuti Bhavatas, your expansions. Yakshe, I wish to worship Vibhuti, your Bhavata, your opulent expansions. Here the word Vibhuti refers to Krishna's opulent expansions within this world, such as the demigods and other empowered beings. So he was seeing wherever any opulence, yad yad vibhuti mat, satvam, srimat urjitam, evava, whatever is opulent and possesses power in this world, it is empowered by Krishna, it is given that potency by Krishna, or that if Krishna withdrew power from anyone or anything, there would be no power. And people, because we usually identify and feel it is ourselves, our abilities. We're strong, we're intelligent, we can do this, we can do that, but like that, Krishna can remove it. It's not us. It's not us. It's not who we are. And that's one of the frustrations of getting old, because we think so many things are us, and one by one we lose them. We lose our abilities, you know, we lose the person. When we were young, we would look in the mirror and see that person and think that person is us. And as we get older, we lose all our sense of self. It's very frustrating. Very frustrating. Unless, so therefore what we're advised to do is right from the very beginning of our life is get ourselves fixed in who and what we really are. So therefore, as we go through different changes in our life, we don't become frustrated as we see them being taken away from us, because what is truly ours can never be taken away from us. So the bhutis refer to Lord Krishna's opulent expansions within this world, such as the demigods and other empowered beings. So Yudhisthira was seeing, he saw anything that had power in this world as being empowered by Krishna. So in everything he saw Krishna, so he didn't see anything as separate from Krishna. So he wanted to worship those seemingly separated objects as a way of worshipping Krishna, and that was called the Rajasuya sacrifice. Thus Srila Prabhupada treats this verse as follows, that Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is from Prabhupada's purport. They're quoting from Prabhupada's purport. My dear Lord Krishna, the sacrifice known as the Rajasuya Yajna is to be performed by the emperor, and it is to be considered to be the king of all sacrifices. By performing this sacrifice, I wish to satisfy all the demigods who are your empowered representatives within this material world, and I wish that you will kindly help me in this great adventure so it may be successfully executed. As far as the Pandavas are concerned, we have nothing to ask from the demigods. We are personally satisfied by being your devotees. As you say in the Bhagavad Gita, persons who are bewildered by material desires worship the demigods. But our purpose is different. I want to perform the Rajasuya sacrifice and invite the demigods to show them that they have no power independent of you. Very amazing thought, if we consider this, that the demigods have no power independent of Krishna. So if the demigods, who are powerful, have no power independent of Krishna, does that mean that I also have no power independent of Krishna? All the things that I'm proud of actually have little to do with me. They're Krishna's gift. So therefore I don't have a reason to be proud, and therefore I should actually be humble. And use Rishikena, Rishikesha, Sevanam, and use in the service of Krishna whatever he has loaned or temporarily placed in my care. They're your servants, and you are the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Foolish persons with a poor fund of knowledge consider. That's such an interesting phrase that Prabhupada used, old fashioned phrase. Poor fund of knowledge. Because a fund is, when you think of a fund, you think of a financial fund. So someone has funds, a lot of funds at his disposal. So he has a big bank account. So if someone has a poor amount of funds, or he's poor, his funds are very, very limited, practically non-existent. So if someone has a poor fund of not finances, but a poor fund of knowledge, that's a generous way of saying that he's a fool. So, they're your servants. They have no power. Foolish persons with a poor fund of knowledge consider your lordship an ordinary human being. That means foolish persons with a poor fund of knowledge. That means a fool will think that you're an ordinary human being. Why do people think of Krishna as an ordinary human being? Jealous, huh?
He performs activities of common human beings.
Yeah, something. Yes, it's nara lila. His activities, like human-like activities. And why else? Because they don't have faith.
Because they can't imagine anything that's beyond them.
Yeah.
They covered a lot of people's pains, they did.
Yeah, paradise, Maya. Maya takes away. What's it? There's two functionings of the Maya potency. What is it called?
Avayanatmika and something like
yeah.
Covering over and pushing down.
Or pushing, throwing down and then covering over. Get thrown down. Yeah, you get thrown down first, I think.
Yes.
I do, anyway. First I get thrown down, then I get covered over. Some people get covered over, maybe, and then they get thrown down. But Avanakya and the other, yeah, something like that. So the knowledge covered over, the soul, me, the person, has knowledge, but it's covered over. This is what Maya does. It covers our knowledge. And the first knowledge that it covers is who we are. Who is Krishna? Who is Krishna? Who am I? And what is my relationship with Krishna? And then, when it covers over that knowledge, we get a false understanding of who I am. And that's basically what? I'm my body. Regardless of what my body is, whether I'm a dog or a king or a monkey or a human or a
gorilla,
goat, giraffe,
kangaroo.
Yes, that's what I was waiting for. Some kangaroo or an ant. But everyone is thinking this. That's every one of those creatures. And yeah, it's so peculiar. I was recently speaking with a very pious religious Mataji, who was a member of different religion. She just sent me something by email and saying that point about that the self is a combination between the body and the soul, and then the next thing is, well, what about animals? And they don't have souls. But what makes them alive? Well, what do they say? It's like they have intelligence even. Like the kangaroos have enough intelligence that when they see a human, they hop away as fast as they can because, I mean, that's intelligence as far as I can figure. You never know what they're going to do. They might shoot you because they do shoot. They shoot the kangaroos here. But they don't call it shooting. They call it culling. Yes?
Burger.
Huh?
Burger.
Kangaroo burgers? Manual. That's gross. Kaboom. But, you know, they out of the goodness of their hearts, they want to keep the kangaroo population down because there's only enough food there for a certain number of kangaroos, so out of their kindness, because they don't want the kangaroos to go hungry, they shoot them. Figure that out. Right? Because they don't want the kangaroos to get hungry, because there's so many kangaroos, and if there's more kangaroos than grass, they're going to be hungry. So the obvious solution is so that we don't want those kangaroos to suffer, is shoot them.
They don't kill them, they eliminate them.
Oh, they call them.
They eliminate them.
Is that what they call
that's
it?
That's a polite professional.
So that's really, really kind. Poor fund of knowledge. That's a polite way of saying a fool. I mean, it's cruel. It's very cruel. But people are very hard-hearted because of their sinful activities and sinful nature. So if animals aren't alive, what is the difference between a human being and an animal? I mean, in the characteristics, of course, a human being has more intelligence, but what was Prabhupada's answer to that?
Polished animal.
Yeah, but what did he say? Well, humans have more intelligence, that's the difference. He'd say, well, a child doesn't have much intelligence. Does that mean you can kill the child?
Mm.
Does that mean they're not alive? Huh? How can you say that they don't have souls? They're alive but don't have souls? Then what's the meaning of being alive? What it's, a soul causes you to be alive, and another creature has the same characteristics of life. You maybe have more intelligence, maybe you have this and that, but they have the same characteristic of life, but they're not alive. They don't have souls? It just doesn't... Because the simplest ABC philosophical point, because it's not clearly understood. Because they're so attached to the body.
And also they're attached to each other's eating. They're not the family is or the world is, and so they can't quite acknowledge that animals aren't just there like a
commodity.
Yeah. It's industry, the beef industry. Mm.
But also, they can't even see themselves like that. Mm. It's very inconsistent. Very inconsistent.
So, what was the point from the dialogue?
Well, just that. But even intelligent, sincere, religious, pious people
cover.
They have a profound knowledge. Unfortunately. Foolish persons with a poor fund of knowledge consider your lordship an ordinary human being. So who they are, who the Supreme is, and what the relationship between them and the Supreme are the three very basic things that are covered. This is Tatsavit Brahma. And sometimes they try to find fault in you, and sometimes they defame you. Why is Prabhupada bringing that in? Who, if they don't believe in Krishna, why are they going to find fault and defame him?
They want to say he has no eyes, he has no legs. Prabhupada says if you were to say to somebody, if they took you into their garden and you said, this is my garden, and then you said it's all false, it doesn't exist, you don't have it, you would be insulting.
And also they insult Krishna directly. They say, if I fought with him, I even heard that when, after you left Bangladesh, one of those people said to me from the school, or one of the relatives of the lady in the school, he said to me, how could you worship a god who dances with the wives of others in the middle of the night? So that's finding fault, because they don't understand. The philosophy of, so that's finding fault. Or he steals. Your God's a thief. Our God, everything belongs to him, so how could he be a thief? So anyway, they find fault with him. It's an envious mentality, because if you put that statement together, how could you worship a God who, so if he's God, how could you judge a God? If he's a god and you're just a fool, just an ordinary person, how can you judge him? So, sometimes they try to find fault in you, and sometimes they defame you and criticize and. But the fact is that Krishna, the person, the Supreme Person, is very difficult to understand. Very mysterious. Very mysterious. Very mysterious. It's like if you see the king in his private quarters, just playing. How are you going to... playing with his grandchildren or something like that and... that's playing and joking. How will you understand that this is the person who sits on the throne and demands that this person be killed and that person be killed and has the right to do anything he wants? So unless one sees the continuity of identity and allows the king to do act as he likes, because if you're sitting... you can criticize the king when he's in his private quarters, But what happens if you, when you're, if he's in his court, sitting on his throne, surrounded by his army, you try to criticize him? What happens? It's over. Because he's not allowed to tolerate it there, because you'll find out his power. Yes, you might have seen him play, and his grandson riding on his back as if he's a little horse, as if he's the horseback rider and the horse, and you may think, oh, he's not powerful because his even his grandson can ride on top of him. But you try to do that when you try and ride on his back when he's when he's sitting on his throne, when he's in his role as the king, and you'll see what will happen. You'll be dead very quick, or in prison. So the conclusion is that Yudhisthira is understanding these type of mentalities. I wish to perform the Rajasuya Yajna. I wish to invite all the demigods, beginning with Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, and other exalted chiefs of the heavenly planets, in that great assembly of the demigods from all parts of the universe. I want to substantiate, I want to prove that you are the Supreme Personality of Godhead and that everyone is your servant. So Sanatana Dharma means that we are by constitution, by nature, unavoidably Krishna's servant. We can't do anything about it. We can turn our back on Krishna and not serve him directly, but we end up serving everyone anyway. We can't avoid the fact that our very nature is servant. When you go and fix people's things in their houses, they're convinced that you're their servant, aren't they? I mean, it's... You know, we get into these businesses trying to get a little mastership going, but we end up we just can't avoid. You get married, and you end up increasing the amount of people that you have to serve. That's all. See, and the phone's ringing just to get me out of trouble before I get myself in trouble here, and everyone else too. You become the president or something, thinking that I'll be the. But you have so many people you have to serve, continuously, always, because everyone always wants something from you, always. They want you to do this, and they want you to do that, and they want you to do that, and they want you to do that. Continuous. It's just unavoidable. That's the very nature of this world. The more entangled we become in trying to lord it over the world, the more entangled we become in having to serve. Mm. It's most peculiar. And therefore a sadhu, his business is to minimize his attachments so he doesn't have to serve everyone in this world. Mm. So he can be free to pursue his spiritual life. Specifically for that, so he performs tapasya, austerity, that allows him to be detached from the material world, so he can pursue his spiritual life, so he doesn't have to become entangled in unlimited material service, especially the service of the body. So Yudhisthira wanted to show that everyone is a servant of Krishna, the Supreme Personality of God, and he wants to hold this Rajasuya sacrifice. So tomorrow we shall continue, Krishna willing, with text 4. Any questions or comments?
Yeah. I was just wondering, we don't supposed to understand this, but when Krishna came to Uddhava and asked him what to do, to go to here or to the king's first, but 5 hours before he was divided into 16,000
things. Yes, yes, exactly.
So why does the dilemma.
Yeah, I remember mentioning that point, seeing that point. It's funny, isn't it?
Extraordinary.
So Krishna really, obviously didn't really need Uddhava's help. If he wanted to, he could have gone to both places simultaneously, easily, obviously.
So it's just to give
credit.
Is it a particular rasa?
To glorify Uddhava, but to give Uddhava pleasure.
But also nobody at all understood that he divided his system. Nobody knew that. In all of Dwarka, nobody knew that.
But okay, if in all of Dwarka no one knew it, then he could have done that, and he could have gone to Jarasandha, and also no one would have known it.
And he waited 3 months.
Huh?
And he waited 3 months.
And he waited 3 months.
He said, but then he was going to go with his friends, you see.
He could have expanded that. He's done that too. He does that when in the 86th chapter, when Krishna pleases his devotees from Dwarka, he goes to the Brahmin, what's his name, Srutadev and Bahulasva, and he's with a whole bunch of sages, and they all divide up. So this is all Krishna's pastime and rasa.
He did do it, and he didn't tell anyone.
Well, he didn't tell me. And he only told you.
Then he came back and covered it up.
But he was already there. That's the other point. He's already there in the king's heart and Zarathustra's heart.
So easy for a person who doesn't have the training and being able to understand, the seriousness to understand, to just find that the whole thing seems like a silly muddle or something, you know, and having to take it seriously and just dismiss everything.
But what?
It doesn't follow threads of logic.
You know. It definitely doesn't. He's because Krishna imitates the ways of ordinary people. So he steals butter. Why did he steal butter? So it has to do with rasa. It evokes something very special within Mother Yasoda.
And all the ladies as well.
And all the ladies.
That was his way of reciprocating with them. Go to their houses and take their
things. So he goes back and forth between, you see this even in Vrindavan, he goes back and forth, he'll act as if he's a human being, and then he does something completely extraordinary, completely unhuman-like, and then he acts just like a human being for a while, and then does something completely extraordinary, as if to remind us when he's acting like a human, that he's acting as if he was human.
And then he's free.
He's free. He's the only one who's actually free.
Where is acting?
Where what?
Just acting.
Acting.
Acting part.
It's funny though, it's such an interesting point. And it's only in the last chapter that he's done this. So when Srila Vyasadeva is telling us this, and Sukadeva Goswami is telling us, he's expecting that we should notice this too, if we read carefully. So therefore, we're seeing the great mystery of Krishna. And of course, if Krishna wants, he doesn't even have to go to Magadha to kill Jarasvani. He just go.
Send
his chakra, or. He could empower one of the kings, or have Jarasandha slip when taking a bath and on the soap and break his neck. He can do anything. His heart, his own heart can attack him.
I was just thinking on this point that you're raised also, but go to someone with a dilemma like that of two options, it's actually very intimate.
Right.
Because you're going in the faith of that person, that he'll, you know, I'll trust what he'll It's a very intimate thing to do.
When someone asks you a question, you know, that really brings you close.
Yeah.
Brings you close to that person.
Yeah.
So that's
if we think how we feel sometimes for them, probably can't listen. If it's really a deep thing, then it draws on you.
The better it makes you. if you have too many coming to you like that, you want to get out of town.
Well, if you're a table president.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
But even more amazing than any of that is that in Gauralila is that the Nawab Hussain Shah and the Chand Qazi are Jarasandha and Kamsa. And they're written down history books.
Yeah. And who was the Kura? Someone has told me. He's in Gauralila, he's Gopinath something or other. No. But there's something quite mysterious. Is an interesting person too. Okay, we better stop though, otherwise we'll go late and tomorrow. Oh, some people say that he's Keshava Bharti Maharaj, who gave Mahaprabhu sannyas. Did you want to?
Yeah, so what kind of capacity does the jiva have to understand this mystery of Krishna's actions?
Depends on his consciousness apart. And if he is very deep hearted and has a lot of bhakti, then the understanding from Shastra comes into his heart and he can realize it. As much as Krishna allows him to understand, not everything about Krishna. A lot. And then with the residents of Vrindavan, they understand so many things about Krishna, but to them they don't even care. Because for them, the loving relationship with him is dominant. So they even know the things about him, but it doesn't lessen their love for him. No one understands everything, only Krishna. We can only have a little part. And to accept the part as the whole is illusion. But that's all we can do practically. So we can choose what kind of illusion we can be in, either Mahamaya or Yogamaya. And we can't even choose. We can choose, but we can't make it complete even to get out of it. But let's stop now because we can take rest properly. Tomorrow, and then Wednesday is Balaram's appearance day.
Yep.
So what type of program is in the evening? The top. Yes. Thanks.